Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, an international interfaith meeting in the city of St. Francis explores ways in which religions and environmental groups can work closer together to protect our planet. Hear from Catholic, Anglican and Reformed Church leaders about how our rich faith traditions can draw on their ancient wisdom to meet this pressing challenge. Tread lightly. Live simply and love deeply. That was the message of an interfaith meeting in Assisi recently, bringing together representatives of a dozen faith communities around the world with leading environmental experts. The Alliance of Religions and Conservation, or ARC, was set up by the World Wildlife Fund as a way of combining the ancient wisdom of the world's great religions and the latest environmental technology. A rather unlikely alliance, you might think. Yet since its foundation 25 years ago, it's made some surprising progress persuading religions and civic authorities to work together for the benefit of future generations. That's why, a quarter of a century on from their first meeting in Assisi, ARC was back in the Umbrian hill town to launch its latest initiative, a green pilgrimage network of shrines and cities across the globe. But let's go back a moment to the beginning of the story. Church of England lay reader Martin Palmer is Secretary General and one of the founders of ARC.
I wrote a book back in 1983 for schools in Britain, which was the first ever book that explored the relationship between religion and how we view the planet, how we view creation, nature. And it looked at eight different belief systems, from Christianity through to Chinese religion, from the Yanomamo through to humanists, and looked at the fact that depending on what story we tell of why it's all here, that shapes what we then think we could or should or should not do with it, a degree of protection. Prince Philip read the book, and he was at that time the international president of WWF International, Worldwide Fund of Nature. And he it was who, at a big meeting of WWF International, said, look, if the environmental crisis was a crisis of knowledge, be over. We know the problems. We know what's going wrong. The trouble is we're not touching people. We're not actually changing lives. We're not touching their hearts and their minds. And he said there are only two things that have ever done that positively, religion and the arts, and very often they're synonymous. So it was his suggestion that we should come 1986, to Assisi, bring or invite religious leaders from five faiths to join us to explore if this was at all possible. Was this an issue they cared about? Was this something they could do? And it was so successful. WWF got the largest media coverage it's ever had for any event anywhere, that out of that grew an informal network working with the faiths, helping them to explore their teachings, discover their own traditions, festivals, old habits, old ways of doing things which were sustainable, but which had been sort of slightly lost sight of in the modern era. And then in 1995, Prince Philip and I founded the Alliance of Religions and Conservation, deliberately as a secular body. Funding comes from secular sources. People often say, you know, we've never heard of you. We go, good. Because the aim really is that we help the faiths to do what they probably would have got round to doing, but maybe in a few decades' time. That is, to launch environmental projects based on what they own, what they believe, what they invest in, what they do, and to bring them in partnership with relevant conservation and scientific bodies so they don't have to reinvent ecology, but they do actually make it their own.
It is a very unlikely partnership, isn't it? I mean, some would say that the environmental movement is the most secular, aggressively secular body, and that perhaps it is out to exploit religious communities in some way. Do you ever get that sense?
Oh, all the time. Because basically, most secular groups, when they come to us, they say, now, what we would really like is our message to be preached in the mosque on the Friday, the synagogue on a Saturday, and the church on the Sunday. And here's the message, and we think it'll be very useful if they would go and preach this now. And we go, well, sorry, that's not how it works. No, I mean, the secular world views religion as essentially an ethical code which is useful when it agrees with them. Our response is therefore to take any group, the World Bank, for example, UNDP, many of the conservation bodies, on a journey of their own, which is to realize that they themselves are not value-free. They are deeply culturally shaped. often ironically by the Judeo-Christian tradition, which they most vehemently reject. But they're often the most apocalyptic end-of-the-world people you're ever likely to meet, far more so than the average sort of preacher on a high street. So part of it is actually helping the secular groups to realise that they transmit values themselves. They themselves are carriers of cultural values, which are often at conflict with what they think they're saying. And therefore, our role is to broker. These are worlds that have not spoken to each other for 200 years in many cases. There is deep suspicion on both sides. Our role is to break down those suspicions, but to make sure that any partnership is actually a partnership, not an exploitation, either by the secular or by the religious.
You've been talking about an increase in fundamentalism on both sides, the secular and the religious, and this is a cause of great concern.
It is, but I always take heart from a comment that a friend of mine made years ago, and he said, if you're at a swimming pool, where does most of the noise come from? And I said, the shallow end, he said, exactly. And I think that's what we've got to remember. The shallow end makes all this noise. That's because they're the most insecure. But I would say, and I've worked with every major religion, every major secular organisation concerned with the environment for the last 25 years, I would say that 90% of people care because it's good and they're good people. Maximum 10% want to hammer you into the ground if you don't agree with them. We like to give some kind of voice to the 90%.
You're working, as you say, across the different church traditions, across the different faiths. Some would say it's an incredibly unlikely mix. It's a very confusing mix. You're actually papering over profound theological differences. How do you respond to that particular accusation?
Well, because we don't. We are not interested in some kind of superficial unity. When we did the first Assisi in 86, everybody expected we'd come out with one theological statement and one religious statement. And we said, no, we've got five different traditions here. They're all completely different. They don't agree. That's why they have members that belong to them. No, what we do is we tend to work one by one with each of the faith traditions. Every so often, it's useful to bring them together so they can share experiences. But we don't claim they believe the same thing. We don't claim that they are all in agreement on everything. What we do say is, come proud of your own tradition, but humble enough to listen.
Do you think it can add value, though, to the ecumenical and interfaith movement, this work on the ecology, on the environment together?
Yes, because I think it's a bigger subject than just whether we're actually talking about the same God. And I think an awful lot of interfaith dialogue is monumentally dull, because it's religions talking about religions to other religions. What we always do is we always have a secular partner. So our main secular partner here is the UN, the Norwegian government. They set the question. The religions come in response to that and come with their responses. When religions talk to religions, often all it is platitudes. Here we're saying, there is a crisis. Here are the secular groups. Have you anything to contribute? Have you anything to say? And if you have, come and join us.
Finally, what do you see as the achievements of a conference of this kind?
Well, we're quite cunning. We already have at least 70% of the results ready before we come. And so we've launched this new Green Pilgrimage Network. We've launched a greening of the Hajj, which starts a few days after this event finishes. We've launched two new long-term plans, one in Mongolia, one in Egypt. So that's already there in the bag. We don't hold an event unless there's something new to announce. But what also comes out of this is the next round of major commitments that faiths will make. And to be honest, until they tell us what they want, we're not quite sure.
There are some very good ideas coming out of this. How do you monitor implementation of these very grand and very ambitious projects?
We don't. We have to trust the faiths. We are a tiny staff. And our role is not to monitor the religions. Our role is to ask the religions to be faith consistent. And by giving major media coverage, like yourself, we make it clear to the believers that their leaders have said this. They're very good at keeping them on the straight and narrow.
The Judeo-Christian tradition has a lot to say about our responsibility to respect and care for creation, starting with the book of Genesis. Yet it's only within the last few years that Catholic Church leaders have begun speaking out about ecology and urging people to become much more environmentally aware, a pattern found in other faith traditions as well. Award-winning journalist and producer Mary Colwell is the Catholic Programme Advisor for ARC, as well as serving as a consultant to the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales.
All the world's major faiths have slowly come to this dawning, some quicker than others, and some sections of the world's faiths quicker than other sections. So there is a general awakening, which is very interesting, among all the world's faiths. So the Catholic Church wasn't alone. And I think it's been driven by grassroots. It's been driven by your ordinary people who go to church on a Sunday, but who care about the world's wildlife, the world's environment, fresh water, forests, animals, plants, how we live. And they wanted the church to take some kind of... They wanted to be able to put that into the church, and in a way forced it into the church. And I think the church has responded. There have also been, of course, some really strong leadership from John Paul II and Pope Benedict. So there has been a pincer movement driven from the top and the bottom, and I think it is moving us forwards.
What do you see as the most important actions at grassroots level that, as you say, can help to push the leaders in that direction, if you like?
I think talk about it and live it. Talk about it, say to them, we want you to make a difference. We want you to start talking about this. Look, we want to be a Live Simply parish, the CAFOD Live Simply campaign, and we want to show our local community that our faith community here, our church buildings, what we do in terms of our faith is green and sustainable, and we want it to be led from the front as well as from the grassroots. So I think what ordinary pew-going Catholics can do is demand, if you like, that the hierarchy take this seriously in the nicest possible way. And also, but to lead by example and say, this is really important to us. We know this is part of our faith. And together, I think the whole church will start moving forwards. I think it's happening, and it's happening sporadically. We just need to join the dots a lot more.
You're coming at it from your Catholic perspective. This is also going on, for example, in the UK across all the other churches, denominations, and indeed all the other faiths, isn't it? Do you see this as an important ecumenical interfaith area?
I think it's hugely important. There are many, many, many things that divide the world's religions, tenets of theology and so on, but we all eat, we all drink, we all need to have fresh water and clean air. We all need the natural world to be thriving and nourishing for our own mental health, our spiritual health, and our physical health. It's a great binder. Concern for the earth cuts straight across boundaries, whether that's political or religious, and we can all find this as a way to move together without compromising our own beliefs, without compromising that. But we can move together on these hugely important issues, which not just affect our own lives, but will affect the lives of our children and their children.
There are many who would see this as a very idealistic vision, something that we in the West can afford to do. It's not so for many countries where people are struggling to feed their families.
I think that's a good point, but I think it's something nobody can afford to let go of. It is a luxury, if you like. Do I buy this organic mango or do I eat a locally grown apple? You know, on that level, it's a privilege to be able to choose. But if we don't do the right thing, if not every person lives in harmony with their environment, wherever they live and whatever standard they live, things will only get worse. So the poor will get poorer. And we will start to poison the world around us and at a distance. And I think that's the big thing that climate change has told us, that if we don't live in the right way, not only do we damage ourselves and our local environment, but we're also causing sea level rise and desertification in parts of the world which could be thousands of miles away. It affects us all, and we all have a responsibility. It's not a rich or a poor issue, it's an individual issue.
Tell us a bit more about the idea behind the Green Pilgrimage Network. What is this aiming to do?
pilgrimage is one of those things, like the environment, if you like, which is common to many, many, many faiths. It seems to be an inbuilt, innate desire in us to go and physically move ourselves to a holy place and be there in that environment. And so we share pilgrimage across faiths, the desire for pilgrimage. And so the Green Pilgrimage Network, again, works within each faith tradition, but across a lot of faiths to say, if you are a pilgrim, a Christian pilgrim, a Muslim pilgrim, a Hindu pilgrim, think about what you're doing. Think not just about the spiritual aspect of it, but the sort of impact on the world as you do it, because that's your faith as well. So it's not just the significance of that shrine, it's the whole witness of how you get there, what you do when you're there, and what you bring back is all part of the package. You can't separate that out.
You're working together with spiritual, religious leaders, also with civic leaders in these cities that have become the first members to sign up to the network. In many cases, this may well also encourage greater cooperation, perhaps, between religion and society in these countries. Have you found that?
I think it's been quite astonishing how, you know, people who thought that they weren't really connected, so people who run local councils hadn't really thought of themselves as sort of sitting side by side with the people who run the faith shrines, but suddenly realising, well, of course we sit side by side with them because people are visiting the city, coming to this place, and we need to work together to do that. It's, you know, in that modern phrase, it's a no-brainer, really. And it's surprising it's taken this long for people to realise it. Because, of course, what challenges Etchmiadzin in Armenia or Kano in Nigeria, what challenges those places to make their pilgrimages green is very different to what challenges St Albans in England or Trondheim in Norway. We're talking incredibly different places, very different standards of living, very different outlooks on the world. But we all share pilgrimage in common, and so Kano can talk to St Albans and say, what we've found is this, and you could try this, and we can work together. That's what's been so fascinating.
You're talking about these pilgrimage sites, these religious traditions, which have centuries, millennia in some cases, of wisdom and history and experience to bring to this debate. Why is it that the rich tradition of faith has been unable so far, perhaps, to bring this vision to bear?
It's a hard question to answer, isn't it, that one? I think as the world has got more consumerist, then to preach self-restraint and simple living and wise use of resources and being humble before God is not what people want to hear. They want to hear about all the new gizmos they can have and how much they can do. And that's very human. I mean, of course we all want to have fun and have a nice, easy lifestyle. And religion challenges that as a very basic level and said, you know, well, maybe that's okay sometimes. Maybe it is okay to have periods of great feasting where you really can spoil yourself, but it must be counterbalanced by periods of restraint and periods of sort of reflection and simplicity. And I think that's what's missing from the consumerist society. We're all about having and not about giving up. And I think religion finds that a very difficult message to give, but it's one we really need to hear. And I think as the world goes into recession, as it seems to be, it's a message actually that's being heard more.
One of the messages that is coming through here is that if we manage to somehow work more closely together to work on the environment, perhaps there will be some solutions to the current financial crisis.
I think what the current economic crisis is doing is making people reassess how they're spending their money and how they're living, maybe all being forced to think, well, do I really need to spend that? Do I really need that? And that's quite a new question for the richer countries of the world. It's not whether do I need it, it's do I want it? And I think it's forcing many people to reassess what's important to them. So you're only going to spend your money on what is important. And if you're a person of faith, then that has to be informed by your faith.
The Christian faith can and should encourage believers to tread lightly on our earth, live simply without wasting resources, and love and rejoice in all of God's creation, as St. Francis taught so eloquently 8 centuries ago. But to understand exactly what that means for us today is not always an easy concept to grasp. Sometimes it entails moving away from our physical and spiritual comfort zones, just as pilgrimages often take us far from home. Reverend Richard Fraser is minister of the Church of Scotland's Greyfriars Kirk in Edinburgh city centre.
I've always been keen on walking out in the hills, ever since I was in the Cubs. At the age of 8, I suppose I was introduced to hill walking. But I went on a pilgrimage walk from the first time about 15 years ago, and I walked from the island of Iona on the west coast of Scotland, right across Scotland to Aberdeen, where I was at that time minister. And I was minister in this lovely medieval church that goes back to the Celtic period, founded by a saint called Machar, who was one of Columba's companions. So I was in the footsteps of Machar, crossing the whole land of Scotland from west to east. And it was a transformative experience because I realised that the journey was an extraordinary opportunity to encounter new ideas, to develop, deepen relationships with the people that you were walking with, to find that you were learning new things as you journeyed, and that you realise that the destination is perhaps less important than the journey, and that, I think many people have said this, that home is the journey.
This idea of relationships with other people, it's a crucial part of the pilgrimage experience, isn't it? In a way of learning more about other people, their ways of thinking, their ways of living.
There are all sorts of things in the Bible about hospitality and about strangers and about the empty-handed stranger being the source of great insight, of great blessing to people. If you're open, it goes right back to the Old Testament. Abraham at the Oaks of Mamre offered hospitality to strangers, and at that moment, his barren and aged wife, Sarah, bore him a child, Isaac. And it was because of their willingness to offer hospitality, and it's one of the great traditions of the ancient world, is the principle of hospitality. And I think when you encounter strangers, when you open yourself to the possibility of newness and new perspectives, then it deepens your own grasp of your own traditions and your own understanding of where you are on the journey. And so the anticipation of gifts, the empty-handed stranger being the bearer of sometimes the most priceless gifts. Just think of the disciples on the road to Emmaus who meet this stranger, and they're bamboozled and perplexed by this man who doesn't seem to know what's been going on in Jerusalem for the last few days. But he's the one whom, when they share stories and share hospitality, they realise that they've encountered the risen Christ. So the idea of pilgrimage, of going on a journey, and of anticipating gifts from outside as being something that deepens your own experience and your own understanding and your own grasp of God is absolutely fundamental, I think, really important. And I think one of the risks that we've got is that we stay within our familiar comfort zones, our particular traditions, and we don't allow our traditions to evolve because of the encounters we have. And that's where I think it's what's been so exciting about this week is that we've learned so much from each other. And as someone just said just a few minutes ago, you know, this week is a pilgrimage.
You seem to be suggesting that pilgrimage perhaps is a key way of pursuing the ecumenical dialogue. We hear so much talk about an ecumenical winter. You seem to be suggesting that perhaps pilgrimage is a tool or a key to the way forward.
Well, I think it could potentially be. I mean, I think one of the things that we've often done in the past with ecumenism, with the churches trying to dialogue together in Scotland and throughout the UK, is that we've been knocking on doors that have been closed to us. And also the other thing that we've done is that we've really, in a sense, tackled things from a top-down perspective. And always at the top, that's where power resides. And people do not want to give up power. But the interesting thing about the pilgrim is that they're very much vulnerable on the road. And this whole issue of pilgrimage being associated with reconnecting with the environment is so important. And that's a door that's open. And one of the things that we're seeing in Scotland, which I think is very exciting, is that the Church of Scotland, which is reformed and I suppose maybe a generation ago would have frowned on the idea of people going on pilgrimages, are actually rediscovering that ancient tradition And it's a tradition that we can now share with our Catholic brothers and sisters. It's telling a story of our Christian tradition that is far deeper than just the last 400 years since the Reformation. You know, the one thing that John Knox didn't do was to set up a new church. He was reforming the Catholic Church. It was a reformed church. And therefore, our traditions go much further back than just the Reformation. And by rediscovering these things, by rediscovering our cultural and religious inheritance, and rediscovering these pathways through our country, I think we're also rediscovering something about our environment too, that's fundamentally important.
The other problem, of course, that all the churches are facing throughout Europe in particular is a growing secularism, a lack of interest in the churches. Do you think in some way pilgrimage can perhaps help to bring people back to the churches in some way? Can it help to tackle this phenomenon of secularism, if you like?
Yeah, I think there's a real appetite out there. I think a lot of people are going... It's interesting, someone just said that, you know, in the course of this conference, that tourism is one of the worst examples of materialism. I'm not sure if that's quite the case, because I think there are quite sophisticated tourists out there who are actually looking for meaningful engagement with other cultures, meaningful engagement with ideas. And therefore, you know, tourism is actually quite a noble thing. And I think part of it is that a lot of tourists are actually pilgrims. They're looking for... They're not just wanting to lie on a beach. They're wanting to learn something. And the other thing that I thought was just magnificent this week, from the Taoist tradition in China, the professor from China that was speaking talked about this idea of the yin of global development, of economic development, needing to be balanced by the yang of spiritual understanding and insight and the ideas of sufficiency and restraint and knowing when enough is enough. And one of the things that we've got in our secular society in the UK is that we have this obsession with economic growth, but we so desperately need people from spiritual traditions, from all spiritual traditions, who I think all share this idea of what is enough? What is it that will give us the kind of satisfaction and sense of community that we're looking for? And in some ways, it's beautifully encapsulated by that yin and yang idea, which I think we can all embrace, which is that development, on one hand, needs to be restrained by respect and reverence and a sense of proportion on the other.
What would you say gives you most hope in your experience as a church leader there in Edinburgh at the moment?
I think probably the fact that the church has come through a period over the last 25 or 30 years of being, in some ways with some justification, sidelined by the community, because it has been such a source of imperial power, such... You know, there are people who genuinely feel the church, that when they hear a minister speak or they discover that I'm a minister, they expect me to be quite judgmental, to wag my finger, to expect to be heard, because the church has been so much a part of the establishment for so many years. But we're in a new situation now where the church has to earn respect by what it does and what it's seen to be doing. And therefore, I think the church is hugely well positioned, and Martin talked about this through the week, of coming back to the table, not with an expectation of a hearing, not telling people what to do, but offering to people in a very, very gentle but prophetic way insight and wisdom from our spiritual traditions that will be the wisdom for survival for humanity. So I feel that it's just about the most exciting time for generations to be part of the Christian Church. And I'm filled with hope.
My thanks there to Reverend Richard Fraser, Minister of the Church of Scotland's Greyfriars Kirk in Edinburgh. And earlier you heard Mary Colwell, advisor to the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, and Martin Palmer, General Secretary of the Alliance for Religions and Conservation. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.